Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Today at noon, Joe Biden became the nation's 46th president and delivered a powerful inaugural address calling on the need to unify a divided nation to end the uncivil war racking the country and fighting falsehoods that are the source of toxic division across America. His ceremony came 2 weeks exactly since former President Donald Trump incited a mob to attack the Capitol to stop Congress from certifying Biden as president. Joining us today to discuss Biden's address and what it means are Heather Connolly of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Dr. Patrick Cronin of the Hudson Institute, and Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, who joins us every week for our business report. Everybody, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here with you.
Delighted to be here, Vago.
Great to be here, Vago, as always.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA, our land warfare coverage. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. I want to get into policy specifics in a minute, but first would like to go around the horn with you each and get your impressions on what was a powerful and heartfelt address that I think will go down in history as pitch perfect for the moment that we're in. Unfortunately, no sooner had it ended that some criticized Biden for lacking foreign policy specifics in the speech. But I don't think that was the point, because it would have, something that became kind of a point by point domestic and foreign policy list would have diluted it. I think he kept it simple and focused to underscore the gravity of the moment. He did reassure allies and said that the United States would be back to its global leadership role. But he understands that really at the end of the day, unity is the source of strength for the United States, and unity at home translates into strength abroad, stressing that violence or insurrection won't be tolerated. Heather, start us off on sort of your gut reaction to the speech and how the speech was received globally.
Yeah, I mean, I felt the speech was absolutely a balm for the nation. It was a sermon. It was authentic. The president spoke from his heart. And I think the last thing we needed was a wonk speech that, was 18,000 lists of the things that he was going to accomplish, because we can accomplish nothing if we are not a united country. And so I thought it was perfect for me. It was reminiscent, lots of references to Abraham Lincoln's speech from the early invocation all the way through. It was magnificent. It was a wonderful tone. For me, I thought the two sentences that struck me for my world in transatlantic relations, his message of we are going to repair alliances for tomorrow's challenges, I know we'll come back to that. And this, we're going to lead and live by example and become trusted partners, that the bonds of trust has been deeply, deeply broken between the United States and our closest partners and allies. We're not gonna snap our fingers and that trust is coming back. We have to earn it. We have to build that back. And it's going to take a lot of work that's going to go beyond the 4 years of the Biden administration. But I thought it was just fantastic.
I think you speak for many, and I know Heather, you and I both on the record and off the record have talked about this. Patrick, you too, and Ron, you as well. Patrick, give us sort of your sense on what your takeaways, your emotions were, and how do you think folks, especially listening in the Indo-Pacific, received this address?
Well, first, I thought that the president was speaking directly to the American people and to all Americans, from calling this a great nation, reminding us that we're good people. Now let's live up to those ideals. Let's make sure we secure liberty at home and make sure we are a beacon to the world. And I think that message hopefully will mobilize Americans around a more unified political agenda, because the agenda is tough. If I can just relate this to more strategy in Asia, the notion of domestic harmony as a prerequisite to national strength is an old idea. It's echoed in ancient Chinese writing, where there's disharmony in a nation, it cannot launch an army. That's something Americans experienced and failed in the Vietnam War. We validated Clausewitz's insight about the importance of the trinity of people and popular will having to be aligned with the military and government. And if they're out of alignment, we can't really act effectively abroad either. The one caveat to this speech, of course, is that while we focus on quieting discord at home, our competitors are not going to stop. They're not going to stop sowing mischief abroad in creating those complications. I mean, Biden gets that, but at the same time, we're going to have to not only bring this harmony at home and bring Americans together in unity, but also then figure out how we catch up with an agenda that we're behind on abroad because of the last 4 years.
Ron, what was your sense listening to the address?
And I agree with Heather and Patrick. I think more from, if you look at it from an investment point of view, the focus on unity versus chaos, right? As we've talked about in the podcast before, markets generally don't like uncertainty. And it was a speech that I would say was trying to address, quell uncertainty, quell the chaos, that kind of thing. So when you look at, you know, the market today closed pretty flattish. You didn't see much of a difference between commercial aerospace or defense. I don't think there was anything in the speech that would have jumped out to the investment community, particularly if you look at the from the lens of the, you know, the defense sector. President Biden said anything that would be all that worrying.
There was what's really interesting is that the market is beginning to become increasingly disconnected from events, right? So if there wasn't all that much to worry about, I think that it's really interesting in the market, as opposed to going up, right? Wow, unity, this is great. It was like, eh.
Well, I would push back on that, however. I would argue that the market isn't all that disconnected from events. And my argument would be this. There's been, and the expectation is, given the comments, not in the speech, but over the last couple of days about another $1.9 trillion of stimulus and then more stimulus after that, I mean, the market has reacted to a tremendous amount of stimulus, not just in the U.S., but globally, right? I mean, we're talking around the world with $20 trillion of stimulus or more, something like that. That for sure is going to work its way into the markets. And I think that's what you're seeing in the market.
Does this internal focus on unity suggest potential adversaries that will actually be absorbed and be taking our eye off the ball, right? I mean, everybody worries, and history has proven that every new administration does face a major national security challenge in the first 6 months. If the focus that the United States has is on domestic unity or discord, does that give opportunity to adversaries? Does it disturb allies that look at this, right? So it's a positive on the one hand. On the other hand, do they go, boy, these guys really are neck deep on their own problems and aren't going to be really paying attention?
Well, I think it's very clear adversaries take advantage of a disunited country, an inward-looking country. And, you know, certainly over the last several weeks, we have seen both Moscow and Beijing point to the chaos that Ron mentions and says, you know, these guys aren't any better. They keep telling us, you know, keep preaching to us about human rights and democracy and rule of law. And, you know, look at this. So, I mean, the moral authority that the United States has lost over the last 2 months, that will have impact the next time an American official goes to speak out about events, you know, Uyghur re-education camps to the poisoning of Russian opposition figures. We've lost that moral authority. So that's an important issue, I think, to keep in mind as we rebuild our credibility and rebuild that trust. I think looking at the last 2 months, when you look at Russian disinformation, you know, discrediting democracy, Russia could do nothing that the president of the United States was not doing to the United States. And so I think there's also a point where the adversary has to sit back and just say, let it go, when they're taking care of their own business. But having said this, as the Biden administration now begins, I think I've tried to lower expectations in some ways with our European colleagues and our allies, not because I don't think the intention is there to come back, reestablish ourselves. That was clear from President Biden's inauguration speech. But we have to be realistic that the United States is going to be focused on vaccination distribution and getting COVID-19 under control, building that economic structure back while it's attempting to rebuild relationships and meet challenges from North Korea, Iran, China, Russia, just to name a few. So this is massive. And this is, again, going back to if we are not united and we don't agree on these challenges and meeting these challenges, you know, it's going to be awfully hard to rebuild at home, which is essential, and to be strong externally to meet these challenges.
Patrick?
Again, I agree with what Heather said. I mean, we have to get through what President Biden called this dark winter. But in Asia, there's already a discounting of the Biden administration. That is, they already knew Biden was going to bring America back to more predictable diplomacy, more sort of steady engagement, playing by the rules. And that's welcome, and they like that. And the fact that we've appointed Kurt Campbell as the first Indo-Pacific coordinator at the White House is a sign that Biden means business in Asia. There's a second rebalance underway, and that's great. But as Tony Blinken said in his confirmation hearing, we can outcompete China. I think that's where there's more skepticism in Asia. They want to see the proof. They want to see the resources behind it. And that, as Heather suggests, it's going to take time. It's going to take years of effort, adroit diplomacy, working with allies and partners. You just cannot prove that overnight. It's going to take several years.
Ron, how's the market looking at all of these sort of global geopolitical dynamics, right? I mean, what are, you know, we've seen sanction activity and concerns like that. The Biden team is looking at balancing, both, you know, be buy American or rather build American, support American businesses, grow the United States, invest in the future, while at the same time rekindling allies and partners, right? We didn't hear specifics in this address. You know, what are the expectations from the Biden team, especially given that this is a very, very seasoned economic group, right? Janet Yellen, former Fed chair, is going to be the Treasury Secretary. What's the market want to hear from the administration? What does the market hope to convey to the new administration as it starts to shape its policies?
Potential Secretary Lloyd's. Yesterday, when you look at Lloyd Austin's hearing, I don't think we heard anything there that was, you know, concerning from a defense budget perspective. I don't think there was anything all surprising there. So when you look at what the market has discounted, it's been a relatively not that volatile transition, you know, from the last couple of days, I guess, put it that way.
Heather. There are challenges between the United States and Europe, right? I mean, one was the concern that allies and partners have had. You've been talking for a long time. You know, you served in the Bush administration as well. And those frictions were there over the Iraq War. There were perceptions when the Obama administration was pressuring Europe to do more. That was so that the administration could focus more on the Pacific, you know, and made clear, right? I'm up to my knee, up to my neck in Afghanistan and Iraq. I need to pivot. Can you guys do a little bit more for your security? And those requests didn't work, right? I mean, so the Trump administration sort of setting fire to the House did help from that standpoint, but it also played into this sense of drift between the United States and Europe. And then the Biden administration called on Europe, hey, slow down. I know you've been working for 7 years on a trade deal, but can't we just wait until we get into office so that we can craft a collective diplomatic and economic strategy toward Beijing? And Europe pushed them away. And in fact, Armin Laschet, who will replace Angela Merkel as the German chancellor, is not really that big of a fan of America, right? I mean, he likes Nord Stream. He wants to get closer to China. He wants to make sure the Chinese keep buying German cars. At the end of the day, how is this relationship going to work? And what do, you know, how is the administration going to do this, right? What's its message to Europe? What does Europe want from the administration?
Well, I think just at the onset, I think the United States has to profoundly rethink how to engage with allies and partners. We know that allies and partners are essential for America's success, both its economic prosperity and its national security. But we can't keep doing as we have done, honestly, for the last 2 to 3 decades, really since the end of the Cold War. We have to reimagine and rethink this entire proposition. You're absolutely right. There is great American continuity in how we look at Europe, from, you know, demanding that Europe spend more on its defense spending to align more with US interests. But we have to do this now in new ways. The old methods are just not going to work anymore. And I certainly hope the Biden administration, in their focus on an allied-centric foreign and security policy, we just don't go back and do the same thing. We don't relitigate really failure for the past 15 years, particularly when you think of transatlantically. How do we do this in a very new way? The Europeans, you know, we just heard today from European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, you know, a new dawn. They're enthusiastic, obviously. They have an administration that has very similar approaches and thinking from climate change and multilateralism. But I think you're right. We cannot paper over the deep divisions. And the first division is, I think, and the one that if we don't get this right, I don't think we have a more successful transatlantic relationship in the future. And that's on technology. We have a huge battle ahead of us on getting global standards on technology right. We have a huge difference of opinion on China, which was absolutely came out with the EU-China Comprehensive Agreement on Investment. This is what we really have to focus on and get these issues right. Part of it is strengthening Europe itself. We underestimate, I think, Europe's weakness. The more they talk rhetorically about strategic autonomy, it speaks to me that they're scrambling, and they now know that they cannot rely on the United States, but they rely almost entirely on the United States. So that's where those vulnerabilities come through. But we have to have a new approach. We have to think about Europe's strength as our own strength. And I don't believe we're doing that thinking right now, and we're not doing that reorganizing. One thing I think just to note that I'm very excited about is actually the UK's chairmanship of the G7, and then I know nothing makes people more excited than thinking about the G7, yawn, but they're—
Hey, wait a minute. I love G7 meetings, Heather.
Thank you. Okay, I've got my G7 buddies with me. Okay, but what's interesting about this and the utility of it is UK is thinking about putting together what they're calling the Democracy 10. That's joining our European allies with our Indo-Pacific allies and thinking about the great economic challenges, read China. These are some of the new dynamics that we have to put into place, and we have to get moving and do concrete actions, because the EU is in a different position on China, and the Germans are definitely in a different position on China. This is where mercantilism is the greatest priority, and we have to rebalance Europe's approach to China as Patrick noted, as we are rebalancing our own. So huge challenges, lots of elections in Europe this year. It's going to be a dynamic conversation, but I'm hopeful. I think we've got some good things to work with.
Patrick, as the president was speaking, China announced a ban on former Trump cabinet members like Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, Alex Azar from visiting not just China, but Hong Kong and Macau, right? Underscoring its ownership of those two former colonies. Beijing also cracked down on Hong Kong recently, on Hong Kong's democracy movement. And in another complication, the Trump administration changed the longstanding U.S. policy toward Taiwan, right? Putting the incoming team in a bit of a bind. What is Team Biden? And you mentioned Kurt Campbell and just the tremendous asset to have in the job, you know, as you said, sort of the second rebalance, but somebody who has an extraordinary grasp on the region and friendships that can be leveraged to U.S. advantage and insight. But at the end of the day, right, what does Team Biden need to do to be engaging with our allies there? What's the region expecting from Biden, from Kurt, from Tony, the whole team?
From a broad perspective, the Biden administration and the team that Kurt may be coordinating in particular, and he has a lot of excellent players at defense and state and elsewhere inside the administration who are either there today or coming in soon. He needs to, as with our transatlantic relationship, try to align as much as possible our allies and partners in a common direction in terms of setting the rules, because this is what is at stake, whether it's the technology rules, the trading rules, or indeed the use of force. And so in Asia, you have particular trends that are stronger than they were 4 years ago. You have greater Asian nationalism. You have deglobalization in terms of a series of concerns felt differently in different countries about how secure their supply chains are. They've been efficient, but now they need to be trusted and secure. And so they've got to balance security with the economic efficiency. And there's protectionism and economic sovereignty. So that's why it's complicated to put together what Heather referred to, which is very important, a D10, a democracy 10, a technology 10, or some constellation of like-minded countries to help write the rules. So going to your point, Vago, about what was China up to by sanctioning the Trump cabinet at the last minute, it was very much about saying to the Biden administration that we want you to play by China's rules, or at least more predictable rules. When it comes to something like Taiwan or Hong Kong, they want to play by China's rules. When it comes to more global issues, they maybe are willing to make more compromises, but they're still expecting concessions on the part of the United States. So Xi Jinping wants to halt the great decoupling on technology and a movement toward a potential Cold War with China. President Biden is not likely to go in that direction. He's not the petulant sort of leader that his predecessor was. And his Indo-Pacific team, including Kurt Campbell, they're all eager to see America do what Tony Blinken said, which is to try to outcompete China, to try to be the shining example and lead with soft power.
Ron, you know, you, Sash Tusa, Richard Ablafi, and I talk a lot about the decoupling in China on a regular basis, whether on the commercial side of the market, commercial aviation side of the market, but also on technology and trade in general. How, I want to get your sense on where the markets think the relationship with China is going and how the market factors in any sort of mending of damaged relationships, right? I mean, does that move needles up the fact, or, you know, how does the market look at that?
Yeah, I would say a couple things. More broadly on the decoupling, I think the market was late to really fully understand that we are on a path to decoupling, particularly in more sensitive, higher tech markets. You know, think of microprocessors, when 5G is another area, that kind of thing. So if that ends up being softer, creates a broader market opportunity, the market will probably applaud that. But it might be with a little bit confusion in that, I think the market's going to say, well, weren't we decoupling for a reason and now we're not? So what's that mean? You know, longer term, what's the risk? Then I would say more specifically in commercial aerospace, China and order activity with Boeing has been slow. So if the relationship with China were to change, maybe that's a good thing for commercial aero. And I think this asks a broader question, right? What will change in terms of things like, will the Department of Commerce have its entity list of military end users? What happens with that? Are there any changes to CFIUS and foreign, direct investment? What does anything change there? How's it changed? And how do we handle that with China? And I would say broadly on the street, there's skepticism around the Biden administration playing tough with China. I would say the view is that the new administration will probably be softer on China than the previous administration. Now, I'm not saying that's the case. It's just my observation.
I've heard that as well in some investors that I've talked to. So let's work this. Patrick, will this administration be tough, right? I mean, in terms of, the United States and the world has not done anything in the wake of the most recent crackdown on Hong Kong. The Uyghur issue is a great talking point, but nobody is getting particularly tough on the Uyghurs at all. And there is this concern that the administration, for domestic trade reasons, will sort of back away, right? Be a little bit more malleable. Although I have to say the Trump administration was more Sturm und Drang than any sort of actual needle moving where it mattered. At the end of the day, your sense on where the team is going to go?
And Vago, that's the key point that you just underscored, which is we can be dramatic. We can call what happened to the Uyghurs genocide, but what happens to China and what happens to our interests and policy as a result? So we have to balance our interests and values here. And that means, as the Biden administration is talking about, we're going to have to target what we really care about. So let's just take on the economic front, an area that, you know, transcends my expertise in terms of focusing on China, but the modified restrictions and reforms that we need to undertake is one box of thorny issues that are highlighted in a great CSIS report by Scott Kennedy. But not included in that box are lots of things that are we already want to do unilaterally or that we need to do on China. So we can narrow down where we have to focus and then try our best to mobilize others around an effective agenda. And I think that will make Biden both tougher on China, but also more realistic in terms of we may be able to succeed with a strategy that narrows down our differences on what really matters.
Heather, last question goes to you as we wrap up, unfortunately. How does the Biden administration need to respond to Russia? Obviously, there's an ongoing cyber attack. It was discovered late last year, but maybe one of the largest cyber intelligence operations ever against the United States. And it may, in fact, take a long time to oust Russian intelligence from all of the networks that have been compromised. At the end of the day, how does the new team need to be tough and engaging with Russia in a way that actually moves the needle, that dissuades Russia from foreign assassinations and the kind of risk tolerance they've grown accustomed to?
Paco, it's a fantastic question. And I think the Biden administration, you know, really one of the first decisions it's going to have to make, as Secretary Designate Tony Blinken mentioned yesterday, is extending the New START treaty. So arms control is going to be a really important part of the U.S.-Russian dialogue, absolutely, because we now have a crumbling arms control framework, and we have Russia working on some new weapon systems that we really need to address. So that's first off the bat. But you're right, from cyber attacks, disinformation, looking at malign influence, not only in Europe, but Africa, Latin America. We're looking at growing Sino-Russian cooperation. So these are the issues that the Biden administration is going to have to grapple. And quite frankly, you have two camps within the administration, one that want a very, very tough line on Russia, you know, other parts that want to see a strategy that allows us to work with Russia, whether it's on the Iran nuclear agreement, on specific issues. But it's going to be very, very hard to do that. But I think if the most hopeful I am is that we have an administration now that will have one united Russia policy. As the last 4 years, you had the administration with one policy and Donald Trump with a divisive strategy that was against his own administration vis-a-vis Russia. So at least we have a consolidated approach here, but these issues are extremely tough. Just as Patrick said, if we don't have an allied approach, if our European allies are not aligned with us on Russia, which in some areas they are, in some areas they aren't, this isn't going to be successful. So the same applies to all the major challenges. And I think this is where President Biden has it absolutely right. Allies and partners are essential to America's strategy.
I just wanted to add about the declassified Indo-Pacific strategy. This is a point that Heather highlighted that is very important for the Asians. The gap between a coherent strategy that was written on paper in 2017 by the Trump administration and what they actually felt in terms of President Trump's tweets and diplomacy, belittling allies, cajoling and cuddling up to dictators, it was a recipe for a failed policy. And now, at least under the Biden administration, you will have one coherent policy in which there's no separation between President Biden and the Asia team.
Very, very briefly, Patrick, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this, right? Climate looms very, very large in the new administration's list of priorities. And there's this sense that somehow that there may be sort of the quid pro quo, right? I mean, as Heather said, we're trying to accomplish all of these other things, so there may be a limit about how tough we want to get. There is a concern among some, especially those who are tough on China, that the administration will trade too much away, for example, on a China climate deal that actually we care about more than the Chinese care about, or in fact, even the Chinese care about abiding. Very briefly, can you give us a sense on whether those fears are exaggerated or legitimate?
Time will tell, but legitimate sort of policymakers, people like Mitt Romney, have expressed concern that the administration's China policy could be hijacked, if you will, by the climate policy and by the gravitas of someone like John Kerry. I think that's exaggerated. I think, again, someone like Kurt Campbell in the White House will be able to balance these issues so that we can both cooperate with China on climate change to the extent possible, and at the same time, take on China over their malign behavior.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always a pleasure having you guys on. Look forward to having you guys back. And Ron, already looking forward to having you back on again on Sunday. Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, great to be here, Bago. Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.